Thanks very much for joining us. I'm Jonathan Armstrong from Caudry, the specialist compliance law firm. And I'm pleased to say that joining us this time for our head-to-head chat is Susan DeBecker. Susan, thanks very much for joining us. So Susan's now the Director, Risk and Compliance at Microsoft Azure. I had to read that out because it's just a really new role for you. You were previously with Cisco. You were born in Scotland, then educated at Harvard Law School. And then you went into all sorts of sales roles in organizations like GE, selling lighting, which is probably why you look better on camera than I do. And you joined Cisco in 2007. You moved to their compliance function in 2012. And then throughout that, you've been based in the Netherlands, but with increasingly global responsibilities. So I guess the first question is, why compliance? How did you get from where you were into the world of compliance?
Well, I think that's actually a really good question, Jonathan. Thank you for asking. I think I fell into it because for me, it's a logical thing. Compliance really shouldn't be difficult for anybody because it's logic. If you have something that you need to be doing it the right way. So make sure you're doing it the right way. And I think if anything that I learned out of my GE days was it's easier to get it right up front than it is to have to try to fix it later. And if that premise then falls into being compliant, whether it's by a regulatory practice or financial or just by pure logistical thinking, I mean, it's not a difficult step to take. So I worked with Cisco. I came into Cisco when I was working with them under the supply chain area, and then moved into compliance at a later date, helping put together that program because it was a logical progression.
I understand. And you did quite a lot of work, particularly during the pandemic, helping other people in the compliance world understand the risks, partly in supply chains and partly in business units because you'd been there before, but partly bringing the benefits of the sort of working from home on networked model that Cisco had to businesses who all of a sudden had to move to home working through the pandemic. Can you tell us a bit about some of the lessons you've learned over the years that will help people moving to a hybrid working or working from home or whatever the new normal is?
The new normal. Yeah, the new normal for everybody else is like the normal for me. It's an interesting dilemma because people were worried about how do you manage others who work at home? How do you make sure that they're not off just eating bonbons and watching the television? You know, all those mysterious things that people think that happen, and they don't actually. People who work from home tend to step up and do their work. And if you have the right discussions with your manager and your manager with you, they know what you're doing. How you do it and whether you do it in your PJs is completely up to you. But as long as the work gets done, that is what's needed. So then the discussion rolled around to, in the world of compliance, what we knew as a standard. Is it still a standard? Because if I look at where I came from, you know, I looked at very harshly at things like anti-corruption and bribery, conflicts of interest, financial responsibility, EH&S, environmental health safety, those kind of things, part of my compliance tree, which were really important. And I had my prioritization and I knew what I was looking at. But with COVID, everything started changing in that you have to look at people's behavior because at the end of the day, it's people's behavior that sort of dictates the way things are going to change. And if I then look at, say, a sales force, they're then under the gun because many of them, and I'm talking generically across all companies, many of them are paid on commission, right? Well, if your commission starts drying up, you then are into that fraud triangle of the opportunity, et cetera. So people are then looking at how can they make up for the lost revenue. You then suddenly start having suppliers or partners who are in the same basic chain They're all vying for business, trying to survive, offering things at the back end. And suddenly the rules of the road go out the window. Uh-huh. So this is what I was trying to explain to people, is that we have to start thinking in a different way. You also have to start thinking about how you operate at home, because of things like IP and, sorry, I apologize.
It's all right.
Because of IP and remote working and security. A lot of people don't think about that, but I had a delicious story that I shared in one of my meetings, which was a senior salesperson, and this wasn't with my company, it was another company, had been working at home on his computer, putting together a large bid that they were doing. And he got up to have a cup of tea or something this similar, and his kids saw the computer open. Oh, whoopee, dad's computer. So, and it had a form that he was filling out. And what they didn't know was it was one of those sales forms that you fill out about the bids, the discounts, etc. So he got a call, I think it was the next day, from, I think it was not his manager or his manager's manager, but further up the tree, to ask why he had put in a sales request for $37 million. And unbeknownst to him, his kids had filled out this form and put it in. And of course it went through the system of the company. But of course they stopped it because it was ridiculous. And then everybody had a bit of a laugh about it. But what it did bring to light was the fact that he'd left the computer open. His kids had been able to get to it. They had been able to input this information. Had they been someone else, you know, hackers or whatever, they could have gotten into the system. It could have been somebody that worked for a partner company visiting, could have seen. So it's silly little things like that that people have to start thinking about now in more regard.
Yeah.
And companies who were lax a little bit with their security protocols, afraid you're going to have to pump them up a little bit, because now how do people come in the backside to try to make money? So the world of compliance to me, as I knew it, and I was putting programs in place for the coming financial year, was about restating what my compliance focuses were and why, and talking to the board about them or the audit committee, because they have to understand why I'm changing direction. Because of course we all had our plans, right? And everybody knows them. And suddenly I'm going, nope, that's out the window. I'm changing my plan.
Yeah. Now that's it's a really good point, isn't it? And I think we see from the stuff across our desk that many organizations who moved from in-office working to out-of-office working did that in a hurry, and rightly so. And then the good ones are backfilling compliance, if you like, or they're reviewing, thinking, okay, optimistically, we thought we might be in working from home for 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 4 weeks. That clearly hasn't been the case, isn't going to be the case. So what do we need to do? And from an IT point of view, that might be doing patching in a different way. But there might also be compliance systems as well. I mean, one of our biggest data breaches since GDPR has been what I think is a fairly typical home working type issue, where somebody's working in their, happened to be their conservatory at the back of their house because it was a bit more peaceful. Their wife arrived at the front door. She'd lost her key. He went to the front door to let the wife in, and criminal came in through the open conservatory window and took the laptop. Unfortunately, the laptop had details of personnel at secure establishments that had been saved on the hard drive out of policy, but because there were, so the individual thought, legitimate business reasons for doing that. And I guess the whole training thing, we've talked about this before, gets slightly more difficult when people are not in the office and not appearing at sales events. So how do you get around that? Does that have to be little and often? Do you have to be cleverer in the way that you train people and tell them what good behaviors are?
It's a good question. Training is always a problem, because people these days have the attention span of a gnat. We all do, especially if it's about something that we think we know about, or something we've got no interest in. I do, because I came from the environment I came from, most of my discussions were online. And if I could have closed the virtual door and stood in front of it and held in salespeople when they had to come to a sales, compliance training, I would have, because they didn't want to be there. But I think if you, and I'll go to what I say a lot about is relevancy. If you make it real to people, they tend to understand. I don't talk down to people, or I don't patronize them, or say, here's a presentation, here's 24 bullet points, you must, because everybody knows it's going to go in here and out there. What I try to do is get them to understand why it's important to us and for them to think of it themselves. So when you look at training, look at all sorts of different ways of doing it, whether it's by short video clips, VODs, or games that you play, or discussions that you have, or one-to-ones, or even getting train the trainer. So you might train their manager to do it. Or if you even make it part of their performance review, there are all sorts of things that you can do, because what you want people to be able to do is say that they understand what you're talking about. They might not know the details, but they know that they can go to Susan DeBecker to ask her for the detail if they need it. And that's one of the key things, I think, in the world of compliance, is getting people who are willing to ask that question. Because I don't expect a sales guy to become a compliance expert. Yeah. I expect a sales guy to say, well, I know that this isn't right, and I know because it's not in policy, and I know that it is against the rules. I'm not quite sure why. Let me reach out to Susan DeBecker. I know her name's in the frame. I'll call her, because I would rather have that than have something happen to them or the company. And I think that's the things that we have to aim for. So be inventive. Think outside the box. And know that, what is it they say, that a static presentation, people only learn 5% of it. And if you're doing it long distance and remote, you know that everybody's going to be playing on their cell phone. Yeah. So you have to be engaging, and don't make it an hour. I mean, an hour in front of the computer, looking at a screen, it doesn't work. So make them short, sharp, and sweet. Leave the audience guessing is what I like to do.
No, it's a good point. I think we've said, when we've been doing programs for clients, the way I like to look at it often is, you don't need to teach people to put out fires. You need to teach people how to press a fire alarm. And I think that sort of level, too often, I think FCPA policies, for example, the worst I see are generally trying to teach people FCPA as if they were sitting in a class at Harvard. And that's not the aim we should have, is it? We should teach people to be curious and suspicious and get help when they need it. One of the other things that you've been really good at is sort of using matrices to assess risk in different locations and different types of risk across business units, etc. And obviously you've worked for large corporations who do that and put resource into that. But that's scalable, isn't it, for smaller businesses to look at the geographies that they're exposed to and the particular risks in different locations or business units?
Oh, absolutely. You don't have to be a big corporate to be able to run that type of program. And in fact, with Cisco, we were quite proud of the fact that we didn't have a huge overbearing compliance group. What we did say was that it's the business that really owns it. My job was to make sure that we had the program, that we knew what we wanted to do. We had our risk domains that were important to our company. And then you go and you talk to people about what's important to them versus our domains and our company directives, so that you can understand where some of the pain points for them are. Whether it's geographic or functionally, it doesn't really matter. The questions are the same. And whether you've got 550,000 people, it really doesn't matter. It's still the same, because you ask the same questions. So using that matrix, helps validate certain pieces of information. And this is outside of the regulatory rules and regulations that we know that are there and they must be done. I always ask the question when I'm looking at compliance, what is the real risk to the company? And how are the elements around me affecting that? And when I then look at what my domains are that are important to my company, I then say, how does that then influence me? And if you make it as uncomplicated as that when you're talking with people, because as you said, they're not experts. Mm-hmm. I don't expect the sales guy to be able to answer that FCPA question for me, or I don't expect the sales guy to be able to say to me, well, we have a large conflicts of interest in this country because of XYZ. But I do expect the sales guy to be able to say to me, yeah, we have a lot of people who like to, you know, take second jobs on board, and they've got their kids working at the company. That's what I expect to hear, because it doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to strip it all out, but it does mean that I can sit with the people and speak about what the problems are around that, sort out what's what and where it needs to be sorted for them to be able to achieve that. So that's where I think people have to remember that you have that sort of combination, and you use the reports to be able to validate how that works in the country, especially globally, or even if you have branches across a country. Because if a branch, and let's use the UK, if you have a branch in Manchester and a branch in Liverpool and one down in Birmingham, and they're all saying the same thing about basic things, then you're having that information validated from groups and you know that you're on the right track.
Mm-hmm. No, good point. I guess the final topic we might cover is, I know you've been passionate, and it's part of, we touched on it already, about making sure that what you're saying is designed for the audience. So if you've got a workforce entirely of millennials like you and I, that might be different messaging than if you were speaking to older or younger generations. Has that changed during the pandemic, or are those, is that splicing and dicing still relevant?
Well, that's a very interesting question these days, especially. I would sort of say, no, it's still very, very relevant. You have to be relevant for your audience. And I think even more so now. One of the things that I've noticed through COVID is, and this is probably contentious, so people will write to you, but I've been very disappointed in the millennials. And I've even had millennials who work with me tell me the same thing, that they've been disappointed in millennials, of their attitude through COVID. And I think it's, I don't know if it's because they don't take on board the seriousness of it, or if it's the experience, or if they are looking at different problems. So what I've also noticed with the millennials is that they've had a lot more problem adjusting to this. Even though they love the fact that you can, you know, work remotely and work from home, they're also used to the fact that you could go to the coffee shop and, you know, have a cup of coffee and work, you know, just like on the TV. You could do that with friends, you can do that, or you could pop over to somebody's house, you've just got your laptop under your arm and off you go. So they've struggled a lot more because they've lost the social interaction and being able to work that way. We more mature people have sort of accepted it a lot more, plus we may have families or friends and we're used to maybe being able to contain ourselves a bit more. Uh-huh. It's a different generational thing. So one of the things that I try to do through the COVID is try to mix it up a little bit with the different generations in answering both of those areas, because mental health is something that we should all be very aware of through COVID, because it can really take, a lot of people have a lot of struggle with being isolated, being at home, and not being able to correspond with each other, so that they're not actually able to do the job that they want to do or are able to do, and they're not able to learn, because me as a seasoned person is not able to share those things with them. So it is a different way of working on how you actually bring the two together, the younger and the older, and, you know, getting the older over the fear of Zoom and the younger into sort of, you have to listen to this. it is that combination, but you still have to do it. So I tend to work very hard around increased communication. So you have to spend more time talking with people visually on the screen, as well as thinking about what your actual job is, because you have to spend that time talking to them about the software aspects as well as the professional aspects.
Yeah, that's absolutely fascinating. So speak to people, deal with your mental health, cope with a new way of working. I think they're definitely some sound messages to end on. So thanks so much for your time. Obviously, we can re-divert all the hate mail from millennials, but maybe they just won't raise the energy to send it. And so thank you very much, Susan, for those thoughts. And thank you, everybody, for watching us. And there'll be details of some of the things that Susan's talked about and some future videos on the screen below. Thank you. Bye now.